Welcome to Pets Tell the Truth. This program is dedicated to understanding our animal companions on a deeper level. I'm Dr. Agnes Thomas, psychologist and animal telepathic communicator. I'll be your host as we listen to what our animal friends are saying and as we appreciate the way they view the world, their missions, and their spiritual insights. During the first part of the show, I will be discussing animal rescue with my tonight's guests, Alan and Linda Anderson, and their new book called Rescued, Saving Animals from Disaster. The second part of the show, please feel free to call in with questions. The worldwide toll-free number is 877-876-5227. And if you're listening on the computer, it should be on your screen. Today's show is brought to you by Garnett Publishing in Cleveland, Ohio. Garnett is calling for finished manuscripts, so if you have a manuscript that you would like to share and see in print, contact them at www.garnettpublishing.com or telephone them at 216-458-6100. They are the publisher of my book, Pets Tell the Truth, A Mystical Journey into the Animal Mind, and also my Animals Tell the Truth Wisdom Cards. Tonight's guests are Alan and Linda Anderson. They are authors, inspirational speakers, and members of the clergy. They co-founded the Angel Animals Network, dedicated to increasing love and respect for all life, one story at a time. Alan is a computer software trainer, photographer, and writer. Linda is an award-winning playwright and fiction writer. They are the best-selling authors of the Angel Animals series, including Angel Animals, Angel Dogs, Angel Cats, God's Messengers, and their new book that we're going to talk about tonight is called Rescued. Welcome, Alan and Linda.
Well, thank you so much for having us on your show. It's such a privilege. Thank you.
Oh, you're quite welcome. I received a copy of your book, and I must say I love your book. It has just loads of very valuable information about what to do in times of crisis. And I wonder if you would share some of those points with our listeners tonight. Let me ask you, Alan, did you write this book because of the pet rescue situation during Hurricane Katrina? Was that what was the impetus to do this, or were you working on something like this?
Exactly true. That was why we thought it very important for us to bring this message out. And basically, we wrote it to open up this world of animal rescue for the public. I don't know if the public, the general public, the mainstream,
hello,
the rest of all, you know, the Americans that we all are part of, really know that this exists. Animal rescue and animal welfare is in every community. And we just had to share as much as we could that information. And we also wanted to share facts and ways of protecting yourself and protecting your pet. I love, you know, the title, Pets Tell the Truth. I mean, that says it all. They do tell the truth, and they really do need to make sure that their human companions will also tell the truth and work together to do what's right when it comes to protecting their lives.
Yeah, you know, that is my absolute worst nightmare. I have a gang of animals like you do, and it's my absolute worst nightmare that, you know, sometimes I dream that something has happened, like an earthquake or a tornado, and I've lost some of my animals, and I wake up just in a sweat and panic, and it's like my worst dread. So I found in your book some very helpful things. Can you tell us what's like the very first thing that a person should do if their animals are, if they're in the house and there's a disaster, like we had a flood here a little while ago, and we've had tornadoes in Cleveland. I'm in Cleveland. What is the very first thing that you should do?
Well, it's more like what you should do before those things happen is what's really going to save the day. Like, you know that you have your animals, and do you have dogs and cats?
I have just cats.
Cats, okay. So cats are problematic in those kind of disaster situations because they hide.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things you want to do is you want to sort of like, even if you have to make a list of the most typical hiding places that your cats might be.
Well, I know that. Trust me.
Right. Right. But
because
you may
I
have
make
to share
everybody
who's helping you find
where
them.
They're supposed to be. Before I go to bed, before I leave the house, anytime.
Pardon me?
Anytime. I always know where my cats are.
Well, what I'm saying is that if you had to share that with somebody who came in, like a fire person or a rescuer of some sort, if you have it in writing, it's very helpful.
Yeah, many of your listeners may not know exactly where their cats are at. And a lot of times when we're trying to come up with a topic of, you know, well, where is your cat right this moment, especially during the height of a thunderstorm or a crisis of some kind, many of your listeners would wonder, well, you know, if that cat hides, I don't really know. I mean, it would take that our kitty to let me find her instead of me trying to find her. So I think that a lot of times, if you have under the bed or in the basement a certain place or in a certain corner that they go to, or little places where if you or one of your listeners or somebody that was helping out would know automatically to look, at least at that point, there wouldn't be just total loss of where to find the cat.
When I had a house that had a basement,
a lot of times people are not in their house when disaster
strikes.
That's
right.
And so you might even be on vacation somewhere or traveling or doing a lecture or something someplace else. Or you might be at work and you're away from your home and you can't get back right away. So that's why those kind of things are so important. That what's really great now is the ASPCA has what they call a rescue alert sticker. And you can order that from their website, aspca.org. And it's free, and they send this to you. And all you do is you list the types of animals that you have on there, and you date it. And you put that on any entrance to your house so that, let's say there was some reason why somebody had to come into your house to rescue your animals and you weren't there, they would know. Like a lot of times what will happen in a house fire, it might be the human family gets out and they can't get all the animals out. And that alert sticker tells the rescuer what to be looking for when they go back into the house to try to find.
Now, did you say you can download this from the ASPCA? Is
you
that
can order it from there. Mm-hmm. It's free. They send it to you.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah, I just and cats, if there's a fire, they tend to hide and put their nose in places like Kleenex boxes, where they can breathe easier, but they're also difficult to find them.
Exactly. So that's why we're saying if you have a written list of where your animals typically would hide, that's very helpful in those kind of situations. What we ask people to do is we call the 3 P's, prepare, plan, and proactive.
Mm-hmm.
And prepare means that you have a pet evacuation kit that contains everything that your animal would need were you to have to evacuate quickly and be away from your home or to have to stay in your home for a minimum of 72 hours. And so in that kit would be things like the animal's food, their water, their identification papers, like if the names of their vets, that you want to have them microchipped, of course, and have that up to date. You want to have a photo of the pet in that evacuation kit. We usually recommend for people to have that photo also someplace outside of your area. What happens so often in disasters is that the photos are destroyed. So if all the photos of your pet are at home and something were to happen that you are separated from your pet, you don't have any way to post that photo on petfinder.com or pets911 or to put posters up around the neighborhood to be able to find the pet. So those are things that you want to do to prepare. You want to make sure you have medications in that kit. When you go to the vet, ask for an extra bottle of medication so that you can keep that in your pet evacuation kit. And you want to have a carrier for each one of your animals and have identification on that character, that carrier. And on your identification, you want to have at least 2 phone numbers. The phone number of your house is going to be really useless in a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
Because your phone lines will be down. and you're not in your house. So what you want to have is a phone number, you like your cell phone number, and a number of somebody outside of your area who would know where you are. So those are things that people just don't think about, but because we interviewed almost 200 people for this book, we really came up with a lot of research and very practical things that people can do to prepare.
That is really a good idea. It's like taking making copies of your credit cards and putting them in a safe place so that if your wallet's stolen, you can go there and immediately identify the numbers.
Exactly. And what you just said, it's a one-time thing. You don't have to do this over and over again. You're preparing your pet evacuation kit, and you're having that available to you from that point forward. It's simply, you know, doing the things that you need to do in today's world to prepare.
Right. I remember when the president told us we were going to go to war in Iraq,
Afghanistan, to
prepare and buy bottled water and canned food and so on. And I went out and I bought gallons and gallons of bottled water because I had so many animals, and also a lot of food, a lot of kitty litter. I make sure I have a carrier for each of my animals, and just to take care of them in case something happens. And if we get a warning on the news, on the weather channel, I always close up the doors, make sure I get all the animals away from any place where there might be glass, and I usually lock them in one place in the house, usually the bathroom, on an inside wall. When I had a basement in my house, I used to put everybody down the basement, but I live in a condominium now with no basement, so I at least know where the safest inside wall is so that I can put them all together, and then I go in there too until the storm is over.
Well, that's great, and I want to make sure that each of your animals has a collar with the tag and the ID on it. And for those of your listeners who have dogs, one of the things that we learned when we were doing these interviews is the importance of having in your pet evacuation kit one of those little muzzles for dogs. It doesn't have to be, you know, like some big vicious-looking thing, but something that so that because what was happening is people who are trying to get on buses and into rescue boats and all that kind of thing, were they to have a muzzle for the dog, it would be very clear that that dog was not going to bite anybody. Were they to have the dog on a leash, it would be clear that the dog's not going to bite anybody.
Yeah, that's a good idea. That's a good idea, too, because when we're scared, the dogs are scared as well.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't know what's happening.
No.
And just to make sure everybody feels secure, it's the best way to handle your dog in that kind of a situation. I think that what happened in Katrina is the biggest disgrace I've ever seen in my life.
It's outrageous. It was interesting. Even 1 year later, there was a recent article in Time magazine that 91% of all Americans live in places of moderate to high risk of earthquakes and volcanoes, wildfires, flooding, hurricanes, and even terrorism. And yet, when it comes right down to it, only 16% out of that poll said they are prepared in even the minor ways of being prepared for these types of crises and disasters. People are just not taking it seriously, and it's just something that we think passionately about. We are doing the very best we can to bring this book out so maybe the lives of pets and people can be saved if they just do the basics.
I don't see why somebody wouldn't do it. Yeah, I mean, I was very pleased to read in your book that you consider pets as family, because I certainly do. And people in general don't really get it through their head that we are animals too. Human beings are members of the animal kingdom. And we treat our animals exactly like family members. I would do the same for them and go out of my way the same way as I would for a child. They trust us. They depend on us. I talked to a lot of dogs after Katrina that were rescued or that wandered away and then some family took them in. And those four things, I was trying to desensitize them to the trauma, but they would cry out just in agony. And usually if I communicate with an animal, they don't make any vocal sounds. But they were crying out in just agony, not because they went through such a trauma, but because they couldn't find their person and they felt to blame that they didn't take care of them.
No. Oh, that's so sad.
Horrible. Do you have any data on how many animals were rescued during the airlift? Tell us some of the rescue efforts that you talk about in your book, like the airlift to different places and then truck drivers picking up animals and taking them to shelters and so on.
There's one interesting story that kind of sets the whole mood of the book, and that is, in fact, that the animals, like you said a moment ago, are beings, are thinking, are emotional, are all the things that a sentient being would be.
Yes.
Chris Cutter, who is a communication director for the International Fund of Animal Welfare, was in a boat a few days after the levees broke, and they saw a dog swimming in the muck, and he said he steered the boat towards the dog, but instead of allowing him and the rescuers to help them, the dog turned around and swam away from the boat. And then they heard barking coming from inside a house that was nearby where the dog was swimming towards. They followed and they steered to follow the dog, and he led them back to the house where Chris said he found a female dog that was trapped inside barking. As it turns out, according to Chris, this was the dog's girlfriend, and they went ahead and freed the female dog, put this big old shaggy husky dog into their boat, and then the other dog that was trying to leave, showing them where the girlfriend was also put into the boat, and one of the rescuers petted him, you know, for saving his girlfriend on the head and said, "You're such a good boy," and she jerked her hand away from the dog's head as if she touched a sibling, kind of a hot stove, and she said, "My hand is burning." The dog could have saved himself, Chris said, but instead the dog really did need to bring those rescuers to help his girlfriend. It was a beautiful, beautiful story.
Animals incarnate in groups, and I'll talk to animals that are in a fire, and you know that have been in a fire. I can talk to them in the spirit world as well, and they don't run out of the house, and I'll say to them, "Why didn't you escape? There were 20 that were in a fire, and why didn't you try to escape?" And they said, "We're a family, and we wanted to die together as a family." So they come to you in groups. They live in groups. They're very considerate of each other, other members of the groups. And, yes, they will go back for the one that is missing. It's like the lost sheep story. They go back to get that one that's missing. They're very devoted to each other.
It's so true, and you know, I mean, more than most, how true that is. It's just a beautiful thing to watch these animals and how devoted they are to one another and how devoted they are to their human family.
I don't know why they think we deserve it, but I'll tell you. The cover of this book, there is a picture of a dog who looks very, very tired. It's being given water out of a bottle. Who took this picture, Alan? This is so touching that it grabs your heart the minute you look at it.
Troy Snow, he works and takes photographs for the Best Friends No Kill Animal Sanctuary in Utah, and he took this photograph when he was down there, and as it turns out, this dog was a rescue dog that they had at the shelter. The person, Aggie, was in the second story apartment when the levees broke and the water was coming down, and she was forced to evacuate without her dog, and as it turned out, the dog's name was Baby. And she was just devastated. She went from shelter to shelter, temporary shelter to temporary shelter, and finally, after searching, and Best Friends ended up rescuing Baby, found Baby at the Best Friends temporary shelter near the disaster area, and she hugged and squeezed Baby, and Baby was so relieved, and it was just the most beautiful thing. And on our website, there's a picture of this reunion, and she said to the rescuers that are around her, "I lost everything in the storm. I've lost all my possessions, but now that I found Baby, I've lost nothing." And
because wherever they are is where your heart is, and there's just nothing like the love that an animal can give you. There's just nothing like it. And to think of your animal being left behind. I remember watching Fox News and CNN and having the newscasters taking videos and talking to people. There's in one particular really broke my heart. It was a woman sitting on one of these highways that are just barely above water. And the dog was there helping rescue people all day, and then the they were ready to take her, but they wouldn't take her dog. And she said, "I'm not leaving. I cannot leave without this dog." And my heart just identified with her. I couldn't leave without mine either. I don't know how anybody did it. I think what probably happened is that one of the news anchors arranged for the TV crew to pick up in their helicopter, which was separate from the National Guard, to pick up that dog. And I'm hoping that happened, because that will never, ever leave my mind or my heart, is that sight of that woman there crying and saying, "I cannot leave him." And I certainly identify with that.
Oh, yes. Well, it happened. Well, of course, we have many stories like similar to that in the book, where people stayed to protect their pets. And this is one of the messages that we're trying to bring out in the book, and why we're so grateful for your interview and the other ones that we're doing, because there is a big disconnect between the people who make the policies about rescuing and disaster management and the actual people who are in the disaster, who 2 out of 3 American homes have pets. And 70% of people with pets consider them to be family members.
Oh, yes.
So you've got people making decisions about how those family members will be handled, but they're not realizing what a strong bond that is between those people and those pets. And that's one of the big lessons that came out of Hurricane Katrina, where it finally came to the fore of the consciousness to a certain extent. I mean, we still hear all the time about places where things are happening, and they just, you can, Ellen and I just look at each other and say, well, they just still don't get it. You know, I mean, what has to happen for them to get it? They're not understanding that these people will risk their lives to save those pets and to stay with them. And many, many people died because they stayed with their pets.
Yeah, I can believe that, because I certainly would rather die. If they're going to drop an atomic bomb on me, let it drop right in the middle of my house, so we all die together, because I don't want to be without them.
Right. Well, some people were forced to be without them. Some people were just thinking that this is like, well, just the same old, and they were going to be back in a couple of days like they always were. It was sort of a cultural tradition, you might say, in some cases, where they would leave the food and water for the animal, and then they'd be back in a couple of days and everything would be fine.
Yeah, that it would all blow over. And
right. I mean, they had already evacuated 3 times that year. And so these were people who were pretty weary of evacuation, not realizing that the flood would come.
They never dreamed that it would actually, although they've been predicting it in that area for years.
Right.
And I talked to one woman who had evacuated many times and always took her animals. And for some reason, she evacuated, and this time left her 2 cats upstairs. And finally, when she went back, the cats were dead, of course. The water was so high that the wind was so strong, the back of the house fell off. And the one cat was on the bed and just died of starvation. And the other one was in the closet under this huge pool of mud that had now hardened, and she just wanted some closure. Just where are they and what happened to them? And it's very helpful to talk to their animals in the spirit world, because you know where they are and that they're safe. Also, just prior to this, it was very interesting, because just prior to this, I've been able to find animals in the spirit world who want to return. They want to reincarnate, and they want to return to their person. And they told me they would be coming back around that time. And when I contacted them, they said they couldn't come back right now because something terrible was going to happen, and they were needed in the spirit world.
Mm-hmm.
And then after this happened, they were there, and they were helping animals that had died suddenly to just let them know what happened to them.
Right.
And they do a lot of that in the spirit world. The animals communicate with other animals and say, do you know what happened? Do you know that you died and where you are? And but I thought it was interesting that they had some precognition of this kind of event happening, because they were ready to come back, but they delayed that coming back because they were going to be needed there. Mm-hmm. It's very interesting.
It is. Well, it's estimated that 600,000 animals died or were left behind.
That many?
600,000.
Oh, my God. I had no idea it was that big of a number.
Well, this was the largest animal rescue operation in history. And some 5,000 to 10,000 people, most of them on their own dime, came down there to try to rescue animals. And they did rescue thousands of them, but, you know, hundreds of thousands of them died.
Oh, God. What kind of places were they airlifted to? What kind of temporary shelters? Can you share that with the listeners? Like some of the bigger ones you talk about in your book. Could you name that? Those.
Well, the San Diego Humane Society and Marin County off near San Francisco were two of the larger ones that were receiving dogs and cats through the airlift program, and of course they were probably two of the more well-funded and more organized organizations that were facilitating this airlift program.
North Shore Animal League, the Doris Day Animal League Foundation.
Oh, yes.
You know, we have this terrific story from this woman called Barb Peterson. She is a Delta flight attendant, and she was saying, like, she was reading all this stuff and seeing it on TV, and she was saying, what could one person do? And she got the idea that she would start using her Delta buddy passes to bring animals out of there. And so she put out a notice that through work, and she formed a whole group of people who were using their buddy passes either to go to the areas and bring the animals out themselves or to give them to somebody else who was going to the area.
They were bringing
these animals out to, like, Portland, and they were trying to bring them, they were bringing them to no-kill shelters. What was happening because of the, so many animals were coming out and not enough temporary shelter space for them, they had to start bringing them out. And one of the first ones to bring them out was T. Boone Pickens and his wife, Madeline. And we have that whole story in the book where they went to New Orleans and they picked up the first flight of animals, and they work with Continental Airlines. And the woman who runs the PetSafe program for Continental is a woman named Lisa Schopa. We interviewed her. And they had something like 22 flights of the whole plane. And in fact, there's even a photo in the book. You could see a cat in the overhead bin. And the dogs were in the seats, and it was just an amazing,
amazing process. Oh, I hope somebody took pictures of that.
And but Marin Humane, they did something like with a man named Bill McLaughlin, who was not really like a big animal advocate prior to this, and neither was Barb Peterson, but they were just people who said, there's a job that needs to be done here. And Barb Peterson formed Delta's Angels, and Bill McLaughlin and Marin Humane, Captain Sidney Mikado, they did like 60 airlifts out of New Orleans and Houston, and arranged for the animals to have vet care, and then at University of California, Davis, and then, and they flew these animals all over the country. And this guy, he just literally worked night and day. He said he would get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and he'd be working till midnight just trying. I mean, if you can imagine, just even having crates and the right size crates and the right, making sure the refrigeration was right and the flight times were right, or the animals would survive. And there were so many sick animals, and which ones could go and which ones would need special care. It was just an unbelievable thing. They called their project Orphans of the Storm. And it was just an amazing people who did these compassionate, wonderful things for other people because they were trying to get those animals out of there so that they could get on the internet and try to find where the people went and reunite them.
That is absolutely beautiful. I noticed in your book you talked about a lot of celebrities that came down to help. Did they come down to help personally? Did they do any hands-on work, or were they just contributors, or were they just to be part of the publicity? What was your impression of all the celebrities that came?
Well, the one thing that we've noticed that when you're a celebrity, that your name has some power in the media, and a lot of these people were doing what they knew best, and that was to go out and give of themselves, like in public service announcements or in presentations or in other ways that would get the message out of donating and assisting and helping animal organizations in the work they were doing on the Gulf Coast. Many of the people that we personally talked to and we had fill out questionnaires were totally devoted to animal welfare and animal rescue in the way they knew best, and that was to get the word out in the media.
Well, for example, we got a letter from Bridget Bardot. We wrote to her to ask her our interview questions, and she sent a letter back. It was all in French. We had to get a friend of ours who spoke French to translate it for us. But she said in her interview that she had sent an open letter to George Bush, and it was published all over the place. And in it, she was asking for the rescue of the animals. So people contributed in their own way. I guess in our book, one of the strongest celebrity figures was the rescue that Matthew McConaughey and Oprah Winfrey participated in.
Yeah, please tell us about that.
Yeah, that was really an amazing story. We might go back and forth here telling it because it's a little long, but
that's okay. Cool. Take your time.
Dr. James Riopelle told us his story. It's a whole chapter in our book, and in it he talks about he's a physician at the Lindy Boggs Hospital or was at the time. Now they had a standard procedure because they had so many evacuations. If they wanted to have their staff stay at the hospital to care for the patients,
mm-hmm.
they had a standard procedure where they said the staff could bring their family members, human and animal. And so the staff regularly would bring in them. And so they had their family there, and then they had their pets there. Well, this was actually shown on Dateline a couple of weeks ago, all the things that happened at Lindy Boggs. It became virtually an island in the midst of this flood with patients dying and not enough medication and no communication and trying to get the patients airlifted out of there. And it was just a nightmare. It was unbelievable. No electricity.
Oh,
it was
hot.
Horrible. So after they go through all of this and they finally get everybody out of there, the staff is forced to evacuate without their pets. So they knew that Dr. Riopelle was a longtime animal advocate and really loved animals, and Dr. Riopelle made a commitment to them that he would care for the animals until help could arrive. So he was left there in this dark hospital with no electricity. They hadn't managed to airlift some food, and he was left there to care for 45 dogs, 15 cats, and 2 guinea pigs.
Oh my!
And he is a huge hospital, climbing up and down the stairs, trying to keep these animals alive. No air conditioning, of course, in the heat. And he said the biggest danger, he could hear shooting going all around there because there was looters.
Yeah.
But the
yeah.
biggest danger was that the possibility that a natural gas line would burst and the hospital would blow up.
Yeah.
And so he literally risked his life to save these animals, and he stayed there. And his wife, Dr. Jamie Manders, who we also talked to, she was frantically trying to get media attention on this and to get the hospital administrators and anyone who would help to get her husband, and actually 2 of their cats were there, and the rest of these animals out of this hospital.
We spent time with Dr. Riopelle and his wife, and we noticed one thing, and that was that he wasn't like this giant person with muscles and, you know, all the physicality that you would need to do what he accomplished, but somehow, some way, he was able to achieve keeping those animals alive in the severe circumstances. And finally, he was able to, you know, stick it out long enough where we're helpless to be coming.
So what happened was the administrators hired a helicopter and some security people, a couple people to come and get him. And Oprah Winfrey was down there doing her broadcast from Louisiana, Mississippi. She had two programs she was doing down there, and I guess they must have caught wind of this. And she sent the actor, Matthew McConaughey, who was with her, to go with this helicopter to rescue Dr. Riopelle and take a camera with them. So a cameraman was with them, and actually this is on the Oprah Winfrey website. You can go on there and see this. So they arrived on the roof of the building. Dr. Riopelle had been there for 7 days, if you can imagine doing this. And he heard the helicopter. He ran up to the roof. He did not even know who Matthew McConaughey is. and so this guy, he says, comes running towards him, and he thinks it's a reporter. And he introduces himself and says, "Are you the doctor that's here with all the animals and saving all the animals?" And so it took them all day and all night to get those animals out of there, because they had to take them from the floors where they were all the way down the steps into a boat. The boat had to go through all of those obstacles to get to a landing where the helicopter could land, and only as many animals as could fit on the helicopter could go. So this was an unbelievable rescue effort with just very few people working at it. And by the time it was all finished, they then took Dr. Riopelle to a hospital in Baton Rouge, and they were checking on him. And because he was so devoted to saving those animals and wanting to get back to save his own cats, somebody assumed that he must be mentally unbalanced, if you can believe that. After everything this man went through, they wouldn't let him out of the hospital. And his wife was just going ballistic, you know. And so she finally gets a hold of a doctor friend of theirs, and he goes over and he says, "You know, this guy's perfectly sane, and I'm going to take him out of his hospital." And that's how he got out of the hospital. But it was just an amazing story. It was like a movie of the week kind of story.
I was very concerned about the water, the contaminants in the water. There was oil, there was gasoline, there was there were a lot of nuclear waste dumps in that area. Even when it started to dry, the reporters that walked through said that the dust would burn your legs and burn your arms just if you touched it or if it got on you. What about the animals? What about the animals that swam in it? You show some pictures in your book about animals that were washed off when they got to the shelters. What kind of burns and contamination did they have?
Oh, it was awful. A lot of the photographs that we were watching or looking at really, you know, wasn't really there that we could use for mainstream consumption because it was so severe. But the hair, the skin, there were burns all over the animals. They had to be treated, and IVs had to be given because of the poisons that were in the system. And this is both the rescuer and the dogs and the cats that were left behind. It was just an awful thing. One thing that we were often, you know, when we were interviewing the rescuers and they were talking about this, the water and what was the toxic waste land, mm-hmm. when it came to the water, was the odor, and how even if you just got a little bit on your skin, you could feel it. You could itch, and soon there would be red, and soon there would be all sorts of problems. So those that were down there that didn't have proper equipment may have to suffer for a long time to come because of that particular pollution.
And they had what they called Katrina cough. They couldn't. They were so hoarse they couldn't even talk anymore.
Well, sure, it must have burned them too. Because
it did.
Just
I think one of the saddest things, in addition to what you typically saw on TV, was all the people we talked to who were rescuing farm animals.
Tell us about that.
They just suffered terribly. I mean, really, in that 600,000 figure, I'm sure it doesn't even begin to count the number of farm animals that die. When you talk about the thousands of chickens and cows and horses and you name it. And what was happening there was that that water was coming in from the Gulf Coast, and there were all these oil spills. So the oil was in the water, and the oil was just covering everything, all the animals and all the ground. And so even when the water receded, the ground was just useless. And they had to, there were these wonderful people, Deborah Barlow, Hopeful Haven, and Lori Wilson, Rescue Ranch. And they were doing these convoys. They were calling all over the country to get supplies to these farmers so that they could somehow manage to get through the winter until the spring, when they could try to do something with their land to resurrect it.
I have a lot of clients that are farmers, and let me tell you, they love their farm animals the same as we love our pets.
Yes.
They are very bonded with them. They're very careful with them. They have the same type of respect and admiration and attraction to farm animals. I don't care if it's cows. They know each one of their flock. It's really amazing. And they'll call me to see what the cow needs or what the lamb needs, whatever they need, because they pay me for consultations to see. And they're very observant about little changes in their animal's behavior that it would indicate maybe something's wrong, because they call me all the time about these animals. So it's not just pets that live in our house. It's animals in general. And I'm really proud that Americans have this feeling about animals. That's one of the best things about America. It's all living things. And it's really amazing, and it makes me proud when I think of it, that we have the ability to have compassion for everything that's alive. And unfortunately, we see too much of the wrong side of Hollywood on television, and people that watch our television in other countries don't really know what we're about because they're only seeing the Hollywood version. But whereas we really are very loving and very compassionate people.
I agree with you, and the great majority of Americans are, in fact, that. There seems to be, though, this tendency for a percentage that still look at animals in a way that I'm just appalled at when it comes to violence. And I guess that percentage would also look at children and look at their fellow people in the same way. It's just we really do want this book to change attitudes and to really bring forth that kindness and that love that you so beautifully
right.
talked about.
And what they really are. In my book, the same way. And in my book, I talk about the way animals view us and their missions and how they think. And it's just sort of, I would like everybody to awaken to the fact about these animals. But as a psychologist, I can tell you, people that harm their animals aren't very much better towards their wives and children.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's sort of a nasty vein that goes through them, and it generalizes to everything. And even animals that are abused understand this. And I've had a lot of men call me and tell me that when they were younger, and young men are always hostile. Most men, young men, are hostile, and they're trying to make their way in the world. And a lot of times, they think that if they beat their dogs into submission, that just shows how powerful they are and how strong and stuff. And then later in life, they grow up, and then they have great remorse. And when I talk to their animal, they call me and ask me to talk to their animal and ask for forgiveness. And the animal says that there's nothing to forgive because they came into this life for that person to teach that person remorse, regret, and compassion. That was their mission.
That's
so some
beautiful.
People, yes, are brutal to animals, and hopefully the animal's mission was a conversion of heart, because you have to have heart, and you have to have compassion for everything on the earth, or you're not really you're not really a human.
Absolutely.
So tell us what the most poignant thing that, not just in writing the book, did you have any objections to writing the book? Anybody object to you writing the book?
You know, it's interesting. You know, we decided to write the book, and we sent out a little kind of a questionnaire to the rescuers to see if there would be any response, and we put it on a couple of the newsletters that goes out to the rescuers
uh-huh.
and people that you know would be part of the book and with about rescue and reunions. And as it turns out, you know, when we woke up the next day, there were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of emails that have come in for people who wanted to fill out this questionnaire, wanted to be interviewed, wanted to tell their story. So when it comes to objections, there could be, you know, in a sense, people want their story only and not the other person's story. But for the most part, everyone really was supportive and wanted us to share their story.
No, what I meant by my question is, was there any group that objected to it, feels that animals are just animals and that you shouldn't be writing about such a thing and that only human life is valuable? Any political objections?
We didn't hit any objections to the writing of the book, but we do interviews on radio and newspapers all over the country, and that's certainly a question that comes up. You know, why put this focus on rescuing animals when so many people need help? And we explain to them that when you rescue an animal, you're saving an entire family. And
oh, yes.
You are helping people.
But we didn't and initially, when we were writing the book, the answer to your question is, of course, the people that would be paying attention wouldn't necessarily be the people that would automatically object. They're probably paying attention to other things rather than us writing
right.
this book about rescue. So we were fortunate in that way.
I understand some of my friends went down, and a lot of people from Petco and PetSmart went down and so on. And I understand that you got a lot of help from some of these big commercial companies in terms of carriers, and food being sent. I read somewhere that there were, you know, something like 1,000 cases of Rescue Remedy that went. And Rescue Remedy is a homeopathic drug that you use for stress. And the person, I guess, that owned that company sent 1,000 cases of it down there for the animals. Was that your impression that people were willing to donate supplies?
It was. That was a bit of a double-edged sword from what the rescuers told us. They needed supplies, but they had certain supplies that they needed, and they had other supplies that they weren't getting enough of. So they were like getting an overabundance of things that they didn't require, and then they were lacking in other areas, and they got to a point where it became such a warehousing problem on top of everything else that they were trying to do, because they would have to get them, they'd have to inventory them and store them, and then of course when the temporary shelters shut down, then they had to send things away to other places, that the things that they didn't use or need. And so they got to a point where what they were really asking for was gift cards for Walmart or PetSmart or Petco, so that they could buy what they needed, or donations so that they could buy exactly what they needed.
Yeah, that's kind of a catch-22, I guess, in any rescue operation. You get a lot of clothes. I understand that when they had the people in that Astrodome, that they were getting a lot of used clothing and stuff, so those people could change clothes, but they were also lacking some of the larger sizes and so on. So just donating, you know, what was in your closet that you're not using anymore isn't very, it's helpful, but it's not really an organized effort. Whereas, you know, they they need you sizes 1X and 2X, and for women's clothing, they also needed a lot of children's clothing in various sizes and so on. I wish there was some sort of central resource center. Maybe it'll become possible in the coming years to have that sort of a database on the internet where you could go and you would know specifically what is needed rather than just sort of contributing what you think would be needed.
Well, it's very difficult even if they have that because the needs change so rapidly. You know, they will put it up one day and maybe people send tons, literally tons of something, and then it's on that website or it's in that blog, and they have no way to stop it because people are still sending things. So that was one of the things that we did hear pretty regularly was that supplies became, when they got exactly what they needed, it was fantastic. But when they weren't getting what they needed, it was really a burden.
To store all that stuff and inventory it.
Well, exactly. And like for cat food, they needed cat food in small bites rather than large bite cat food. They just didn't, the cats couldn't eat the large bite.
One comment that was made repeatedly, and this was sort of a theme, was that it was amazing how generous individuals were and the organizations. They were sending whatever they could to make it better, and sometimes it did go overboard a bit with too much of this and not enough of that, but the generosity was a theme through the entire disaster.
It was just great. I mean, they sent medical supplies, they sent crates, they sent cots for the volunteers to sleep on, pillows, you name it. I mean, the people just would think, what do you need, and they would send it.
I understand that people actually donated land where the animals could stay, farms and different places where
shelters.
They could stay until they could sort things out.
Yes.
Was this in Louisiana or Mississippi, or where was this? Because somebody told me about this, that these farmers donated huge areas of their farms just for the animals to have someplace to go.
Yes, one of those places was Raceland, where they the Posado Safe Haven set up their operation. That was a big farm.
Do you have any idea in terms of numbers how many animals actually got reunited? It's probably still going on to this day.
It is. It was relatively low. People were so displaced and animals were so displaced that it was hardly, you know, I mean, certainly thousands of them were reunited, but not anything close to what was going on there. And one of the things that we learned when we interviewed Laura Maloney, she's the executive director for the Louisiana SPCA, she said that before the storms, they had 26,000 strays in New Orleans.
Great.
That means that there were 26,000 animals that nobody was even looking for.
Oh, dear.
There really is no way of knowing how many were rescued, much less how many were reunited. But the percentage of the reclaim or the reunited rate was in the area of 20 to 25% for many of the organizations. And at best, they're thinking between 20 and 35,000 that were actually rescued out of that operation. So there's really no way of knowing because these figures are so fluid with different organizations on what how many were rescued.
Did you have an instance, I think I read, I don't remember if I read it in your book, I think I did, about a woman who had a dog and it was tagged, and she went to rescue it, and somebody told her that she was an unfit owner or something like that, and finally the court had to get her dog back for her?
Yes, we had that in our book. That's probably one of the biggest issues going on now is custody disputes, because there are people who were so displaced, and they had no idea that their animals had survived.
Mm-hmm.
And then add to that the fact that they didn't have any idea how you would find out where the animal would be. And so, consequently, they were very late in looking for their animals in many cases. In some cases, they were looking for them immediately. And then some of the rescuers sometimes took the animals because they just made the assumption that the animal had been abused. They just assumed that if somebody had left their animal behind, they didn't deserve to have the animal back.
Yeah, they should not pass judgment.
And some of them were sent to different shelters, and then they were adopted out maybe right away or even within a couple of months. And then finally that person was able to find out that their animal had survived and that they were able to trace it to what shelter. And then the shelters wouldn't tell them who had adopted the animal. Or if they did find out who had adopted the animal, the person wouldn't give the animal back. So there are several lawsuits going on right now about these kinds of things. There's about six that we know of that Best Friends is helping to fund.
Helping to process. We've run out of time, but I want to thank you both very much for being on the show. It was a delight, and your book is a delight. It has many tender stories in it and heartwarming stories. And the book is called Rescued, Saving Animals from Disaster, Life-Changing Stories and Practical Suggestions by Alan and Linda Anderson. It's published by New World Library. It's available pretty much everywhere, isn't it, Linda?
It is. And
people
can visit our
website. It's an outstanding book. And please tell us your website so people can look up on your website.
Yes.
Well, it's rescuedsavinganimals.net. And there's a lot of sample chapters and a lot of information about the book. One quick comment. Animal rescuers are heroes in this country and should be treated as such. They're just some incredible people.
I absolutely agree with you. I think any person that is out there, even donating small amounts of money to animal organizations, are heroes. Yeah. Because animals are one of the best things that has ever happened to mankind. And they've been on the earth a lot longer than we have, and they give us so much and ask for so little. Thank you again, Alan and Linda. It was a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Good night, and God bless all of you animal lovers, and our time is up.